Should we go ahead then?
Yes.
But I just want to pick up something that you were speaking about. You were a bit against CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy.
I hoped you'd pick up on it.
No, because for someone like myself who suffered from depression, CBT is an enormous advantage. I'm very hostile to psychoanalysis, and CBT really is a very sensible way of dealing with depression.
Yes, I mean, I know it has lots of important therapeutic.
It really is to get rid of your negative thoughts and keep a diary and keep it out. So, but what I really, I just wanted to make, you know, wanted to promote CBT. But what I really want to understand is how you became a poet and whether Darwin had influenced you.
Yes, well, I started off with poetry. I mean, I think my mother has some sort of poetry scribbles from when I was about three.
You were scribbling poetry at three?
Well, I knew my letters early, and I liked poems. I liked, you know, I loved, you know, the Jungle Book and Kipling, and the poems in the Jungle Book. You know, a deer leapt up in a pond and wood with a wild deer sup. You know, he was fantastic rhythm, and I loved all that, and I liked animals. So I only read poems about animals. You know,
but that doesn't make you a poet just because you like poetry.
No, but it is a prerequisite.
So how did you become a poet?
Well,
when did you really start writing?
Well, I wrote little poems on and off, and I wrote some when I was 16 in school magazine and so on. Then I really stopped, I guess, until I did classics, as you know, and I wrote just a few sometimes. But then I suppose when I was doing my PhD, I gradually...
What were you doing a PhD on?
Classics. Well, it was in Greek tragedy. It was the idea of consciousness in Greek tragedy. So there was a lot of social science, psychology, anthropology, some psychoanalysis, I regret to say, as well. But, you know, there are important texts there to be read. And but I found that more and more what I was doing was going into poems. So I did start, I suppose it was while I was doing, and I'd spent 7 years over it. I don't know if you heard Corey earlier on talking about how you can get driven into more and more narrow things. But I was very lucky at the time I was doing it. You know, I got a grant and I taught a lot. And I spent 7 years on my PhD, and that was wonderful. I mean, it meant I was very unproductive for a very long time. But it also meant that I could explore all sorts of things.
But you weren't writing poetry then?
I was writing a few poems.
A few poems.
They just came in around
that's
the
edges. That's what I want to know. I mean, it seems... I mean, is it? Does one wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to write a few poems today?
No.
You know, if one's writing a novel or one's doing science, that's the sort of thing one says. You know, what am I going to do today? You know, I'll work on my book or I'll do some experiments. But with poems, does one say, I'm going to write three poems today?
No, and normally three will be rather a lot for one day. Today, you know, it's very hard to find the space and time because they're not sort of economically productive objects. But, you know, you want to keep yourself open. And I like that idea that, you know, if you go to the moon, send a poet. Because it's keeping yourself open, and that's what poets have to do, to ideas about things, words, how you might look at things differently.
So it comes... So how does it come to writing a poem? I mean...
Well, if you want to go back to how did I, quote, become a poet?
Yes.
Well, I gradually found I was writing more and more. And then, you know, after a collection was published, then you think, okay, this is something, not that I can live off, but that this is something that I need to do. And, you know, you can do it for people. There's a strangely sort of, poems exist in this slightly weird limbo of the dative case. You know, the poem is two or four people, but it's also you have to write it. And if you, it's quite interesting in the history of, say, 20th century poetry that when people were writing too much for an audience, the audience were getting too close, it became too cozy. And so, you know, the modernists, Ed Pound, Eliot, threw it off and distanced the people in the audience. And then there was a thing of coming closer together so that Auden brought back much more rhythm and accessibility. So there's always a strange, you know, sort of, maybe not seesaw, but elastic, lengthening and shortening the elastic.
Now, Now, being a descendant of Darwin, that didn't affect your poetry. No. Well, you did write some poetry, but that's more recent, you know.
Yes, so that's very recent. No, it's hard to say, and now I'm doing these Darwin poems, people often ask, how were you affected by... Well, I always knew he was there.
Did you understand his stuff?
No, of course not. I mean, but, you know, I mean, my you know, when I was a little girl, you know, my model, I used to read animal books, and when I went to my grandmother's house, there were lots and lots of books about naturalists, and so the naturalist was, it seemed to me, the natural literary hero, like Dr. Doolittle, for instance. And also there was a kind of practical thing in the garden or whatever. You would always be looking, you would trying to understand, you know, why does the shadow fall like that? What's on the other side of the leaf? Why does the dog do that? And that was inbuilt into the whole family ethos without me noticing it. But I didn't really think about Darwin until I was writing my book about tigers, wild tigers. And I went around Asia, the tiger range countries, asking the field scientists there, you know, what was happening, why were they going extinct? And I took the Origin of Species with me. And it was when I was in northwest Laos on a river. I didn't know that I was going to have to go on a kayak, and I was terrified, actually. It seemed very unsafe, but it was the only way to get to the Mekong River, which was the other side of that jungle. And I, when there weren't any rapids and I'd sort of settled down a bit, and I was looking at, it was the most jungly place I'd been in. You know, it's easy to go to a tiger reserve in India, but... thick lianas, and it was very beautiful. And I thought, this is like Darwin. Okay, wrong continent, but, you know, tropical. And water. And then I thought, well, God, 170 years ago, he was going through similar terrain, and he was learning to understand how species came to be. And I was learning how they were coming to be extinct, because these beautiful jungles were filled with nothing. The animals that I'd bought in Waterstones in Piccadilly, I'd bought this little book about mammals of Southeast Asia. I was really excited. It was, you know, I was going to see these golden cats and everything. They weren't there. The villagers were eating all the jungle because they were so poor.
Gosh.
So that was when I first started engaging with Darwin. And then once I started working on him, you fell in love with him. I don't know if you've ever done any... work on Darwin.
Well, and not done work on Darwin, but evolution is one of my subjects. Yes, I mean, I'm a developmental by embryos is my subject, and the relationship between embryos and evolution. One of the things that I think about. Yes.
Yes. So how's this year and the whole sort of Dawkins God thing affected you and your work and your thinking?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, I'm an atheist, but I'm not against religion in the same way that Richard is. I think, and I've told Richard, that I think that one of the weaknesses of his book is he doesn't really deal with the help that religion gives to many people. My youngest child became a fundamentalist Christian. He had a slight breakdown, and when he was recovering, he was evangelized, and he became a fundamentalist, a born-again Christian. And I never tried to persuade him not to be, because it helped him a great deal. He's now, it's passed through. And I think religion helps many, many people. I think it does also quite a lot of damage, and I'm very much against any religion, you know, interfering in the way that we live. But I think that for many people, religion is a very great help. And so I'm not like Richard, trying to persuade people to give it up. They want to do that, it's fine, so long as they don't interfere.
Yes. I know, I mean, I feel that too, and also with the relation between Darwin and Emma. There's a film that's just come out called Creation.
I just saw it.
Yes.
I didn't think it was very good.
I was very sad that it, I mean...
Did you think it was any good?
No. I mean, I thought there were wonderful performances in it.
The acting was terrific.
The acting was stunning.
Absolutely terrific.
But I was very distressed. There was a distortion of history, because at one point... the little girl, Annie, who dies, she's crying. He finds her crying and says, what's happened? And at Sunday school, the vicar had made her kneel in rock salt, and all her knees were scarred, because she said that dinosaurs had existed. And Darwin is furious, and he puts on his coat, and he's going to go and, I don't know, punch the vicar in the nose, I should think. But Emma persuades him not to, and he was only saying what I teach them every evening. that was completely made up. Yes. That never happened. And it completely skewed the presentation of Emma, because for Emma to stop Darwin from, Charles from going
but
to...
But was Emma after she died or before she...
It was before she died. Before but actually Emma, all Emma's Christianity, you know, she came from, she was Unitarian, and it was all based on inner conscience, not external doctrine. And in fact, when they went to Down Church, she used to turn round when they said the creed, because you know, it was rather embarrassing. She made all the children, you know, so row of seven, turn round to, against the altar, because she didn't believe in the Trinitarian thing. And she would never have dressed up in black lace and thrown herself round on an altar. And it came out of love, because it really, her Christianity became much stronger when her older sister Fanny died.
It was Fanny the one that he had the fantasies about?
That was another Fanny. It was a very popular name. There were a whole lot of endless
quite
Fannies.
Confusing.
Talk about endless forms or endless Fannies. But this was Fanny Wedgwood.
Oh, I see. Sorry.
And she was very, very close to Emma. And they were always sort of two sisters who thought as one. And then she died 7 years before Darwin married her. And she wrote then in her notebook, you know, the thought of the next world, the thought of revelation brings the next world nearer. And she felt that believing in the afterlife was the only way to get through her grief for her sister. So it was her religion was based on love. It wasn't based on that kind of narrow thing.
No.
What did you think about the sort of presentation of the science in it?
Bad. I didn't think it was a good film. I'm terribly sorry. But Richard Dawkins has just brought out a new book, which has had very positive reviews. And I'm absolutely for evolution. And I quite often get invited to have debates with creationists, which I refuse to do, because the evidence for a creator is, to say, somewhat limited, if not totally absent. So there's nothing much to discuss. I'm terribly sorry, sir. I refuse to have these debates, because it implies that there really is something to discuss and there isn't. That isn't to say that all the problems of evolution have been solved. And you were speaking about the first cell, the origin of the first cell, how that evolved. Sorry, that's quite a big problem.
Tell me more about it, because on Wikipedia I found three possibles. One, that it came from a meteor. Two, that there was some deep sea vent. And three, that it was some trick of some atmosphere.
The blunt answer is it's not there. And people are doing experiments. And I mean, I've just written a book about cells thing. And my last chapter is about the origin of the cell, but I don't understand it at all. But they're nor did they. I mean, cells for their size are the most complex objects in the universe.
Okay, there are two, as I understood it, two sorts. There's a prokaryotic and
a
eukaryotic.
Yeah, well,
and the prokaryotic was the first one, and it didn't have membranes inside it. It had everything
outside.
That's
right, just a membrane on the outside.
Yes.
And then later on, there was a membrane on the inside. There was a membrane surrounding the DNA, the genes in the nucleus.
So that was the big invention, as it were, compartmentalizing.
Yes, that was, that was an important invention. But I suppose I argue, and I've written a paper, I don't think anybody's ever quoted this paper, but it has been published, that one of the great, well, given the cell, it was downhill all the way, once the cell was there, then everything became possible. But evolving that first cell is just mind-blowing. And one of my particulars is the evolution of multicellularity. So why did single cells evolve to have an egg, yes, and then give rise to multicellularity? And my story is that there was a mutation in these single cells, the eukaryotic, nice, simple cells, and the cells stuck together just by chance.
Like a double yolk?
No, just a few of them. They divided and they didn't separate. And that had one great advantage. In hard times, when there was no food about, they could eat each other and survive.
And we come from cannibalism.
Yeah, exactly. Altruistic cannibalism is, I claim, the origin of the egg. Bet I'm going to go and give this lecture to three different meetings in Sweden later this year. And that's the origin of the embryo, yes. So there are many difficult evolutionary problems. But the real one is the one you say is the origin of the first cell. and nobody really has a good solution.
Is he going back to God a second? Within 12 months of The Origin coming out in 1860, you know, the man who was then the headmaster of Rugby and was about to be the head of the English Church said, well, it's quite simple. God works through the slow work of natural cause. And Charles Kingsley said, even better than making the world, God makes the world make itself. But you see, and Richard Dawkins would say, well, that's not a good argument. I don't think that's an argument. It's a way of saying, okay, I believe in God, but this is how I square the scientific story with it.
Yeah, I'm afraid it's a perfectly, at least internally consistent story to say that the way God made life was by evolution. He didn't have to do anything.
making is there a metaphor?
Yes. Making is therefore a metaphor. The evidence for God is not terribly good. I went to a lecture recently by a distinguished physicist who is very religious, and he was talking about all the evidence of God from the Bible. And I got up at the end of the lecture and said, and what has God done in the last 2,000 years? And there was a deathly silence. The odd miracle would be really very, very good evidence for the existence of God.
The last 2,000 years could have been worse.
But that's not evidence. I'm terribly sorry. Could have been worse. Yes, that's perfectly true.
Well, Emma says there's a wonderful letter that Emma wrote to Charles.
Really?
Before they were married, he proposed to her rather nervously because he thought he was too ugly and she knew all these languages and things. And to his surprise, she accepted him. And then he felt that he had to come clean about his increasing skepticism about Christian revelation. And it was a bit of a blow. And there's this wonderful letter. You can read it on the net. It's the Correspondence Project. It's one of the best resources on the net there is of their of his letters. And she says, religion is a matter of heart, not intellect. And religious faith is not provable in the scientific way you like, she says. And in a sense, evidence isn't everything.
Are you religious at all? A little?
I've had moments. I think when I my behaviour when I go into a place of faith is probably not what yours would be. Or my inner behaviour, my inner processes aren't. I mean, I would pray.
You would pray?
Yes. Yes.
Well, I think prayer is, once again, one of the things that helps religious people.
Well, I think also it's to do with imagination and openness. And I think, you know, that's what I try and live by, is by thinking new things.
Sure. No, I'm an atheist. I gave up religion when I was about 13. I prayed to God and did my prayers, but I kept on asking God for favours, like to help me find my cricket bat and things like that, and He didn't help, and so I gave up.
Oh, you remind me of when my daughter was her fifth birthday, and she played the violin. She was a very good fiddler, but she made a wish on her birthday cake, and then she said, "I'm going to go and do something," and I knew, oh God, I knew what she was doing. She was going off, and she got out her violin, and she wished to be a wonderful violinist. And then she came back, and she sort of was rather quiet for a bit. She said, "Wishes don't work."
Sorry,
wishes don't work.
Oh, shame. Is she a violinist?
She did. She hasn't played for the last few years, but she was very good when she was 18.
And you've given up your philosophy and classic stuff.
Yes, I was never a philosopher.
Thank goodness, no.
No, I mean, I was married to a very good philosopher. And, you know, he was very nice to me about philosophy, and he said, "You're very good at avoiding all the philosophical problems."
Philosophers are very clever, but they have absolutely nothing of interest to say.
Oh, no, that's not true. That's completely untrue.
Psychoanalysis, I'm hostile to. I'm not hostile to philosophers. It's just they're very clever, but empty, totally empty. And of all the worst of philosophers of science, who have absolutely nothing to say of any interest.
let's give some examples of what they didn't say.
What, philosophers?
Philosophers of science.
Well, they're just, what's his name? Oh, God, you know my memory.
Yes, I know, actually.
Whatever his name is again. Come on, you all know who I mean. Anyhow, all the philosophers of science, forget them. The only
Kuhn, thank you.
Kuhn really
Popper?
Did. Some of Kuhn's ideas are really quite interesting.
So maybe he wasn't entirely a historian of philosophy of science.
He wasn't really quite so much. He actually did. Sorry?
Feyerabend.
Feyerabend, no. But who's the man, you know, the falsification man?
Popper.
Absolute rubbish. Absolutely useless nonsense and pay no attention whatsoever. Any philosopher I take at all seriously is David Hume, who I think is absolutely wonderful in many ways. He was a bit wrong about certain things, I think, but on the whole, I think he's...
What amazing. Do you think he was wrong about?
About cause and effect. I'm a bit involved in the origin of religion, you see, because I claim that what makes us human is to have a concept of cause and effect. And that we evolved a concept of cause and effect in order to make tools. And we are the tool-making animal. Once we had a concept of cause and effect, we wanted to understand the causes of things that affected. That gave rise to tool-making. You've got to have a concept of physical cause and effect in order to make tools. Tools drove human evolution. And once you had a concept of cause and effect, our ancestors, they wanted to understand why we got ill, why we died and things. And that's the origin of religion, because the obvious explanation were sort of human-like
cause
gods.
And effect. There are other animals who work on cause and effect. There are corvids, there are apes.
They do it very badly. And all the animal behaviorists ignore my ideas completely because they all want to say how clever their animals are. Believe me, they're not that. Yes, there are... They do use stones to break nuts, and there are these birds that do amazing things with sticks.
But corvids can count.
No, please, I'm not saying that your dogs and cats are unintelligent in some of these birds. They're doing very nicely, but really compared to humans, there's absolutely nothing there. And there's a wonderful statement that any animal other than a human being seeing the wind blowing the branches of a fruit tree and the fruit falling off would not know that they could get the fruit by shaking the branch. No animal would know that. They could learn it, but they would never understand it. No.
They might find out.
Yes, but any human would know that if they saw the wind, they went and shook it, that it would come off. And any child would know that, but no animal would.
But if animals, there are some tool-making animals, then we need something else being... tool making, and as well as being cause and effect, we need something else as well.
Who we?
The humans.
No.
No,
I think it gave rise to language too. Okay. You see, you don't have a concept of cause and effect. Verbs don't mean anything. So I really think cause and effect is what makes us human. I mean, I know it's not a popular idea, but then one has to live with unpopular ideas.
We're not very good. Yeah, but we're not too hot on it. Look at the mess our world is. Global warming is cause and effect, but we've somehow got that cause and effect wrong.
Well, I don't know if we've... Well, you mean to say the model... You don't think global warming really is due to human activities?
Don't you?
I'm out of my depth. I have to trust these other scientists, and they say it is, and the evidence that they present...
Yes, I believe it is.
I believe it is.
And therefore we... But, you know, until very, very recently, it was being denied our capability. All right, okay, I know it's like your mutation of your double yolk cells. You can have your cause and effect mechanism.
No, but we're
mutated.
Very bad at judging things. And one of my arguments is that when it comes to science, science is unnatural in the sense that any common sense view you have about the world and how it works is scientifically false. I mean, science doesn't come naturally. And global warming is an unnatural idea, and therefore it's science, and that's why it's difficult for people to get to.
When I was doing these tiger trips, there were some wonderful...
Wonderful to do tiger
trips.
It was in India, mainly?
I was in India, but also Bhutan and Nepal and Russia and China.
You were obsessed with tigers?
Well, I wanted... They're a wonderful thing to be obsessed with.
A little frightening, no?
The tigers weren't so frightening as the other things. Snakes was one of the, and breaking my ankle, because they all live now on the highest places. You have to go through the ridge trails. Sumatra was the worst, because it's a very violent land in lots of different ways.
Sorry, but I interrupted you. You were telling me about the tigers.
I met these wonderful field scientists who really were, you know, they're scientists who also have to, be political, because they're dealing with local people and how to make a balance between protect not killing the tiger that is killing your yaks, and so on, and also the poachers, and also the timber loggers and the politicians who are trying to. But these field scientists were holding on to the ideals of science in very difficult circumstances. And, you know, there was a wonderful one, he's Indian, in South India. He said, well, you know, a scientist should be the first to say he or she doesn't know. You know, science is always going forward and never getting to the truth. And, you know, it was very moving to hear that in, you know, when there are insects crawling up your back and you know, politicians putting bombs under your car because you were saying that the forest isn't being looked after, but it's being logged, and corruption and so on.
No, global warming isn't an easy concept. And there are people who are, I can't judge it. In fact, there's lots of science I can't judge. I can't judge the Big Bang. You know, can you judge the Big Bang? and then someone spoke about earlier, you know, quantum physics and all that. It's terribly hard stuff.
It's so divided. I was rereading C.P. Snow's lecture on the two, you know, because 50 years ago that he wrote that lecture, the two cultures.
Yes.
And I wondered then if scientists could understand each other's science more easily than they can now. Because what he was saying in that was, you know, it's outrageous. You go to these literary parties and hear people that, you know, they're just completely scientifically illiterate. But I wondered if now scientists are illiterate in each other's fields.
I think we are a bit illiterate, but I think we trust it. We know vaguely who to trust, and we do at least understand our own little bit of science. In my own field, I'm getting old, and I'm a bit out of my depth now with some of the technology in my own field, which is about cells. It's getting pretty complicated again. But I do think it is important to realize that science does go against common sense. I mean, just for example, when you're traveling in an aeroplane at a constant speed of 400 miles an hour, what is the force acting on you? And the answer is there isn't one. Because force doesn't cause movement, it causes acceleration. And this just goes against all common sense.
Well, what is force?
It causes acceleration. It causes the change in speed of an object. That's what force is. That's how Newton defined it. And I have many nice puzzles about science. Well, if you're in a swimming pool, yes, in a little boat, yes, and you've got a bag of stones in the boat, and you take the bag of stones and you throw them into the water, and they sink. Does the level of the swimming pool, you know, on the wall go up, down, or remain the same? I do this to millions of people. They all get it wrong. It actually goes down. I won't explain to you. Archimedes would have been absolutely shocked that we were so dumb as to not.
Why?
Why does it go down? Because when you throw it in, it displaces less water than it's required in order for it to be floating in the boat. So in order, as Archimedes pointed out, for something to float, it must dispose its own weight of water, displace its own weight in water.
Oh, so the boat gets lighter and the stones are at the bottom of the pool.
Yeah,
the pool goes up.
Yes. No, the pool goes down.
Yeah, I'm doing down.
Yeah, it's amazing.
What do you think is the most exciting development in your field in the last sort of 5 years?
Ooh, boy, that's in my field. Well, stem cells are the hot topic at the moment, but I'm slightly nervous that I'm nervous that it's a bit oversold, you know, because cells, as I keep saying, are very, very complicated. And I just... stem cells are very exciting.
Yeah, have they just been discovered? What are stem cells? Sorry, probably everybody here.
Well, the thing is, what's absolutely amazing, we can take one of your cells from your arm and we can manipulate it, change some, put some genes into it, the cell from your arm, put it in culture, and it can give rise to almost every different kind of cell in the body. Now, the winner divides, and we can change its environment. It can generate all the different kind of cells. So if we wanted some of your nerve cells, we could take those cells from your arm, change a little, put in a few things, put it into culture, change the culture conditions, and nerve cells would come out.
Well,
but the essence of a stem cell is a cell divides. Here's a cell, and it divides into two. One remains a stem cell. This goes on to become a skin cell. You see, as we are sitting here, you must have lost, I don't know how many thousand skin cells, and it's replaced by the stem cell dividing and giving rise to another cell.
So stem, what does stem mean?
It's the origin giving rise to. That's
so this
cell.
Is the life force. This is the self-replicating.
Well, no, self-replication will be to give rise to two similar cells. With stem cells, one cell remains the same, and the other cell gives rise to a skin cell. They'll divide again, one of them will become a skin cell, and it remains a stem cell.
So it's a self-sustaining generative.
Well, that is right. But one of the big discoveries was that if you went along to the early embryo and took some of those cells out, they would behave, they could act as stem cells for almost any kind of cell in the body and could almost give rise to a whole body. And in fact, it's just been shown that with mice, you can, from these isolated cells, get a mouse. Quite amazing.
So if you took a tiny bit of my arm,
yes,
half of it would be stem cells and half
No. More than, however complicated you think it is,
it's going to be more complicated.
As I tell all cell biologists, before you go to sleep at night, remember, however clever you think cells are, they are cleverer and more complicated. So there will be stem cells in your arm, but there'll be bone cells and blood cells and all sorts of, you know, you are nothing more, I regret to tell you, than a society of cells.
These things growing on...
That applies to all of you too. I'm terribly sorry. You may not like that, but that's all you are. And just let me remind you, which you should say to yourself every night, I come from a single cell, the fertilized egg. I mean, it's pretty bloody amazing, I must admit.
Wasn't that two cells, the sperm and...
No, I'm terribly sorry, it's from one cell. It's a fertilized egg. It's a single cell. Yes, it's the egg cell, the egg which has become fertilized by the sperm, but it's a single cell. And that gives rise to you, and we don't remember much about that development at all, I'm afraid, as we're developing.
Little blue-green.
We have a pretty good understanding.
When was the first eye? When was the world first seen?
Oh, the evolution of the eye is quite complicated. But there are bacteria and single-celled organs which are light-sensitive. And those related genes are probably also related to the development of our own eye. Goes back a very, very long way. Light-sensitive cells.
But it must have been an extraordinary moment when the world, you know, again, not counting God, was actually seen.
Seeing probably came quite late. Responding to light probably came quite early. Oh, yes, that came quite early. But actually seeing it came quite late. I can't remember exactly how many million years ago. But it is absolutely remarkable. But the story of the origin of the eye, the evolution of the eye, is pretty well understood, yes. It's very nice.
So it's all the cleverness of these cells.
Well, just look at your brain. I mean, we don't understand much of what's going on in there.
Yeah.
And whether we ever will is another matter altogether. It really is very complicated. I mean, while cells for their size are the most complex object in the universe, the brain for its size is even more complex. All those billions of cells talking to each other, and out comes these these words.
And these microphones.
Sorry.
So what's the next thing you're going to write?
I'm writing a book on aging at the moment, but too close to home, I must confess. And it's quite a gloomy, I won't ask you how old you are, but well, I'll be 80 in a month's time.
Well, it's my mother's 90th birthday tonight.
How's she
tomorrow.
Doing?
She's doing fine. She has had carpal tunnel syndrome in her hand, so she can't open things.
But gosh.
She seems, touch wood.
But she manages all right?
Yeah.
Doesn't have someone to look after her?
There's a very nice girl who she lives in Oxford. She's working in Blackwell's, who lives in the house, but she doesn't. She's not there. She's just.
No, there is a bit. One of the things in the book is that the treatment of the old in this country is not as good as it should be, and there are problems. And one of the problems I will address in the book is how long do we really want to live? I mean, wouldn't it be better if we had a gene in us that we all died peacefully at 85?
When my father is...
And we all knew it was going to happen, and it happened... Then bomb.
That's it. That's...